In conjunction with Friday's Day of Listening, KTOO offers this Thanksgiving special featuring segments of personal stories of local residents recorded in January and February of 2009 as part of Juno's participation in the National StoryCorps project. Tonight we'll hear from Renee Guerin-Blood, Connie and Alan Monroe, Kim and Peter Metcalf, Jean Clayton, and Grace Elliott. We'll begin tonight's program by hearing from Renee Guerin-Blood, interviewed by Sue Douglas and edited by Martha Moore.
My name is Renee Guerin, and perhaps for historical reasons I should say my name is Renee Guerin-Blood. I just don't remember anything except Juno as a child and loving it. My grandfather, who wanted to be out of town, he built a very beautiful house out there past Salmon Creek for my grandmother and me, and I grew up there. You know, in the summer, grandmother would open the door in the morning, and I would go out with the dogs and come back when I was hungry. My mother was a working mom. She was a photographer and flew an airplane so she could take her own pictures. And she had a little house not too far from us toward town. So I saw her all the time. I wasn't separated from her in that sense. But in those days, it was a war. My dad was away. I thought it was a very normal upbringing. I went to the movies and I wanted to sing. And my family never told me I couldn't do anything. We didn't have electricity in that house until I think I was about in second grade. But we had an old wind-up Victrola. And everybody gave me books and albums, they used to be called. And I could sing all the lyrics to every Broadway show known to me. As a matter of fact, when I got to do Annie Get Your Gun, ultimately I didn't have to learn a lyric. I'd known it by the time I was 10. If I wanted to sing, my grandmother would stop what she was doing and play the piano for me. I was very indulged. We didn't have a lot. We didn't know what we didn't have. But I had all that freedom and all that encouragement. And we would go to the movies as a family. And I never cared about being in a movie. I loved the movies that said things like, Hammerstein's out front tonight, you know, or send the little kid in and she'll come out. You know, all those hokey, wonderful musicals that they made back then. And then I lived some of those moments. And I actually worked for Mr. Hammerstein. When I left Juno, I was 17, almost 18, and I went to California first. My mother was not about to let me go to New York. She thought California would be safer. Oh, but I had a great aunt that lived down there, and so she thought there was somebody. And I stayed at the Hollywood Studio Club, a YWCA-run women's place, so I was very safe. And, you know, God takes care of fools and girl singers. You know, I just never was threatened. But in those days, I figured there was nothing I couldn't do. And my family let me go. We were in this show with a bunch of stars, and it was supposed to get to Broadway. Well, it closed in San Francisco. So I got on a plane with a one-way ticket and $100 and went to New York anyway. I was 21, just 21. And I figured I'm not going to wait anymore for that's where I want to be. Well, I had worked with Mary Martin in California, and she had chosen me to be her understudy. And so, I mean, I didn't know anything. I was so dumb. And she was the most gracious and generous. She was my mentor for many years. So when I got to New York, I was auditioning for everything. But she would call me up and ask me what I was doing, and I would regale her with all this nonsense that used to make her laugh. And then she was going to do Sound of Music and ask for me. We opened in 59. It's 50 years old this year. And when I went into show business, in all deference to my dad, Blood did not seem like the greatest name to go with, I was told. So I just dropped that and used Renee Guerin. I loved coming back here. I really did. People in New York said, "You're going where? To live with your mother?" And I said, "Yes." I mean, she was the love of my life. People just don't understand. She was the best person I ever knew. And I was lucky that I guess I didn't live with her as a kid. You know, all those issues you take out on the person you live with, I had with my grandmother. So mother was always like this glamorous older sister. So coming back, I had this great opportunity to be in a place which I love. I love Juno. I mean, it's how can you take a deep breath every morning and not love it? Coming back to the Juno I had left in 1954 would have really been tough. I mean, now where the saloons were, there are art galleries, you know, and although I don't like to see the town kind of shut up during the winter because the tourist places are closed. It's a more art-oriented town. We have a theater. We have all kinds of artists and writers. I'm writing books now, and I don't feel strange. And many of my friends that I have, my family of friends that I have here, because I'm an only child, are people I've known all my life. You know, we started out in life together. So there's a shorthand. And on a sunny day, this is paradise.
You've been listening to Renee Guerin Blood, interviewed in 2009 as part of the StoryCorps project. Next, Connie and Alan Monroe, edited by Martha Moore.
My name is Connie Monroe, and I'm 73 years old, and today's date is January 5th, 2009.
My name is Alan Monroe, 76 years of age. It is Juneau, Alaska, and it's my wife I'm talking to. In 1948, moved to a little country school. I started to finish my senior class, and voila, that's where I played basketball. And who did I see but this gorgeous cheerleader? Her name was Connie Lozon.
So I got pregnant and was expelled from school.
Ooh, I was sorry about that.
Yes, I was devastated. One of the wonderful things about moving to Juneau, Alaska, is that in 1971, when we finally got here, the school registration had an alternative high school program whereby the children's parents who did not have a high school diploma had to go to school with the student at the alternative school, Capital School. Because my son really was interested in the program, because it had an intense photography program in the curriculum, he said, "Mom, please come with me." That's where I got my high school diploma, by examination. And so, Alan, I remember coming home telling you I was now a high school graduate. How did you feel about that?
Oh, I was elated.
Why did you make me come to Alaska? What was your reason for coming?
Well, I had a job here. I lost my former job, and I came up here to take another job in the museum field.
I remember moving to Nashville, and we were Catholic at the time, and Catholic Church was not integrated, but I remember my father in Vermont statement over the phone was, "Well, Connie, what are you going to do about it?" And we formed the Catholic Council for Interracial Justice, doing sit-ins at churches in the state. I would say about half of the churches were so excited that we were going to do this. It was about time. The other half told me to go back north where I belong. And I only say that because one of the things that impressed me with you, Alan, is that you insisted that the Children's Museum be integrated, you know, before you signed a contract.
You know, not far from the museum, we had a low-rent barrio, I guess they call them now, and they had this policy where they could only come in on one day a week, and I thought that was pure BS, so I started working against that. Some of the board members brought their kids from the other side of the tracks to the museum and found all these black kids, poor kids running around, and they didn't like it. I got my one-way ticket out of there.
You know, I've been a tourist so much, and I've studied in several countries and so on, and I still think that sometimes you think, Alan, that tourism is not good for Juneau, right?
Right.
I have a different point of view.
Okay.
Because my point of view is I'm a volunteer at the City Museum.
Right.
And it's so exciting to see people coming from all over the United States and different parts of the world.
But a million and over a million in 5 months? Come on. I'm happy in the forest. I'm happy in my studio painting. Those are lone things to do. You're much happier if you're with a group of people. So that would probably explain to me why the tourism thing and meeting people all the time, new one every day or whatever, is important for you. But that's not necessarily important for me, so you have to respect my position, too, on that.
And do you respect mine?
Well, to a degree, but I let you know when I don't.
Connie and Alan Monroe recorded in early 2009. You're listening to a special program featuring selected StoryCorps interviews. On Friday, you're invited to take part in the 6th annual Day of Listening. To find out more, please visit our website, www.ktoo.org. Next, Kim and Peter Metcalf.
we were basically a Catholic neighborhood. We were raised Catholic. The school, the St. Anne's Parochial School, was down on 5th Street, just two blocks below us. And there was easily 50 kids in the neighborhood, wouldn't you say?
I counted before, and it was over 50. And this is a very small area, from 7th Street up to, you know, I counted, not even all the way down 7th, probably from the Kenway's house to the Rapella's house on 7th up to the end of the houses on Basin Row, which was
a
Rosenberger's house. Yeah, two blocks, and there were over 50 kids. Of course, nine of them were from our family.
Yeah, we were instructed by the Sisters of St. Anne's, and that was in the days when the nuns of that order had very strict habits in the sense of their headgear. These were women who were from predominantly Quebec, I believe. They were French-Canadian.
Well, it was a French-Canadian order. Some of them were from there, and some were from the West Coast.
Most of them were good, sturdy teachers. A couple of them were exceptional. And overall, I felt, anyway, that our instruction was pretty good at St. Anne's.
I do, too. It was very regimented, and I think that probably served us well. I mean, we knew that we couldn't get away with anything, and we were lined up from shortest to tallest. We were marched around.
Right. I remember when I first went to high school in freshman year, and the teacher would enter the room, and all the kids from St. Anne's, would be just a couple of us maybe, but we'd stand up.
I did the same thing. I was so embarrassed. Because when an adult came in the room, you stood up and said, "Good morning, Sister Mary."
One of my strongest memories of being in school then, I don't know if you were still there when Kennedy died.
And, I was in high school when that happened.
Yeah, okay. Because we were, said a prayer, of course, and the nuns were really shook up by that because, they were all enamored by John Kennedy, which, of course, our parents were too, because John Kennedy had actually visited Alaska and was taken around Juneau by our father, Vern, and our mother was definitely enamored.
Well, and the story is that I got to meet John Kennedy when I was like 9 years old.
Really?
He came here in 1958 at the invitation of Ernest Greening. To do some campaigning, probably for statehood. I don't really recall why. But our mother was rarely sick when we grew up, but she was sick with the flu. And the deal was that Dad could bring two people to meet Kennedy. I mean, it was a very limited number. And our grandmother was just adored him because he was Irish Catholic, and so
right.
was she.
Right, Helen Flynn.
Yes. So she got to go, and I filled in for our mother, who was just totally out on the couch, sick as a dog. And I remember meeting him. It was at the 20th Century Theater. We raised ourselves. I mean, there were so many kids and families that your mothers just shooed you out the door in the morning, and there was no television. There was no organized games. I mean, you were on your own. And so we had this great crowd of kids to hang out with and play with. And, we split into girls and boys. It was very segregated groupings. But, as Peter said, we camped out. We just ran around from dawn till dusk. It's amazing none of us were killed because we'd play in Gold Creek. And I remember Mike Fleshour, one of my big memories of him, is he would walk the outer rail of the trestle bridge on the wooden bridge on Basin Road.
60-foot drop on one side.
Yeah, and then we were up on the mountains and on the flume, and places that I would never think of letting my kids go when they were that age.
We had the best playground on earth just about, because Basin Road was an abandoned mine works, and they basically left the cigars in the ashtray when they closed down the mine in 1944 with every intention of coming back. And we just spent, especially the boys, would spend endless hours up there exploring the mine works and dragging tools away and leaving a trail of, instead of breadcrumbs, would be wrenches and stuff we drug out of the mines.
I mean, they left the pots and pans in the kitchen. They left books in the library.
We went to see The Great Escape, the movie, and we really got into digging tunnels. And it was almost like a public works project. We all got into it and started digging this tunnel right next to the water tank, actually. And we got fairly deep, and we had a trench going, and then we broke through a mine tunnel.
Oh, my goodness.
And, the rock dropped, you'd wait, and then you'd hear it hit. It was like 800 feet or something. And that just scared the hell out of us. We just abandoned the works and covered it up and didn't tell our parents, as far as I know. But
I do have some memory of that. I don't know why, but
that was the end of our great escape.
And then there were forts. I mean, the boys built incredible forts, and the girls were allowed in if we'd agree to be maids.
Or in the
pretty sexist in those days. Let's face it.
You got to be medics during the battles. Then we got into projectiles, you know, with pipes that were loaded with cherry bombs, and that's when things started getting serious at Basin Road.
Yes, and Mac did one that blew back and shot himself in the head with it. It's lucky he wasn't blinded. And yes, there were accidents on occasion. But
you know, 9 kids grew up on that hillside, our family. Not one of us broke a bone.
I know. It's just amazing. The group of kids that grew up together were still very close friends. And, you know, when I see a neighborhood member or even a St. Anne's person I went through school with, there's a real closeness there. It's more like family.
That was Kim and Peter Metcalf, recorded in 2009 and edited by Katie Bosler, in this special Thanksgiving program of selected StoryCorps interviews. Next, we'll hear from Grace Elliott, produced by Ms. G.
My name is Grace Elliott. I am in the studios of KTOO in Juneau, Alaska, and my partner is my very good friend, Mukhya Kar Khalsa.
My name is Mukhya Kar Khalsa. I was born Muriel Joan Levalady. Grace, I've always really enjoyed your stories about your Irish neighborhood and your Catholic schooling. So I was wondering if you could tell a story about that.
I think the further away in space and time I got from my neighborhood, the more I learned to appreciate what a rich cultural heritage I had when I was growing up. It was just self-evident. Everybody, it was a matter of an article of faith that everybody had a little bit of Irish in them. And I really took that literally as a small child. I just thought, oh, because St. Paddy's Day was a very high holiday and there was always the parade. And when we were small, we would be in school that day and usually there would be some Irish dancers. I remember the Reynolds girls, Siobhan and her older sisters would come in and they would do a reel or some other sort of Irish dance. And it was just a very joyful celebration and everybody celebrated it. When I got a little bit older, the standard operating procedure on St. Paddy's Day was to ditch school and get on the train. And the train would be so full as it came from the south side of the city that by the time it got to my neighborhood, you could cram your body onto the train, but the conductor couldn't get through to pick up tickets, which we all figured out. So, you know, we'd get a free ticket downtown. And then my favorite thing to do was to wait for the pipe bands to come. And there was one in particular that I really loved called the Black Watch. And I would wait till they passed by me, and then I would jump right down into the street, and I'd follow them up one side of the loop and down the other. But that's just St. Paddy's Day, and that's what everybody thinks of when they think of, you know, Irish Americans and celebrating or, you know, feeling your identity as being Irish. But what I've learned over the years is that there are far more subtle things that I never really understood that I was learning and that were just part of who I was and how I operated in the world that had to do with my Irish heritage.
What was the best cultural trait that you would like to keep and have your children also keep?
I don't know if I could pick one. There's two things that I think of simultaneously. One is just big-heartedness, and the other is a love of language and words, and that is certainly something that I grew up with. My mother is deaf on television, so we didn't have one. And there were books everywhere in my house, and absolutely every person I knew in my family and my extended family would use in the course of their speaking to one another bits of poetry. You know, you would be going along and speaking to someone. If you wanted to make a particular point, out would come this line of poetry, and it was just a very natural part of speech. And we all learned, we all read poetry, and we all memorized poetry. Music was a part of our lives always. My mother played the piano every single day of my life. that I can remember. So we were always singing. That was always part of our family parties. And I guess it would be impossible to pin it down to one thing, but I had a very large, fairly wild, but deeply loving family. And, you know.
How many kids?
10 kids in my family. And on my mother's side, there were 60 grandchildren, so I had 50 first cousins. And they all lived fairly close to us at that time when I was small. I had a big clan. That was the other thing. I had a clan identity, and I feel like my family always operated as that. So when I moved to Southeast Alaska, I always felt like I related really well to Tlingit people, people that grew up close to their culture, because there were so many similar attributes. And being part of a clan is a little bit hard to explain. You're just less individuated in a way that I think is very positive, because you know that they have your back.
So then what brought you to Alaska?
Well, a 10-day vacation from which I never returned. I was working in downtown Chicago, working as a paralegal, and I loved it. I loved the city. I loved my job. I'm sure I was working on my first ulcer by the time I was 19. I never did acquire it, by the way, because I cut that short. But I had a dear friend who had come to live with my family for a while when she was a teenager. There had been a tragedy in their family, and so the kids went and lived with other families for a while. And I think largely because of the influence of my father, this woman got interested in Alaska. My dad got Alaska Magazine all the time. From the time I was a very small kid, he was always fascinated by Alaska, wanted to move to Alaska, and, you know, never quite was able to do that. But this friend was on her way to Idaho and decided to make a detour up to Alaska, and I decided while she was here I would come and visit her. And so I did, and it was so beautiful here. It reminded me very much of the places in the Northwoods that my family used to go every year. My parents would throw all 10 kids in a Volkswagen microbus and drive up into Ontario. And that's where we really encountered the natural world and our spiritual lives. That's where I think everybody in my family first encountered themselves truly as a spiritual being, by being in the natural world. And when I got here, it felt like that to me.
Grace Elliott, interviewed by Mukia Khalsa. To close out this show of StoryCorps interviews, we'll hear from Jean Clayton, interviewed by Elma Fassel and produced by Ms. G.
My name is Jean Clayton. I'm 80 years old, and I'm Elma Fassel, age 72. When I grew up, Anchorage was a little town. When I graduated from high school, there were 48 seniors in all of Anchorage. From there, I went to college in Fairbanks, and then my father retired from the railroad, and he wanted to come back down to Haines, where he was from. So I ended up in Haines. I got married, had 4 children. I lived out in Spinard on a homestead. It's now part of the city. We walked a half a mile out to the road to catch the school bus. We had all kinds of animals we had to take care of before we went to school and before my dad went to work. My mother took care of my sister. She was Down syndrome, so the rest of us helped. My brother and I helped my dad.
What about the day you didn't want to go to school? The two of you.
Oh, the day we played hooky.
Yeah.
I was in about 3rd grade, and my brother's probably in 2nd grade. And we heard about this, and it sounded like fun, so we snuck out of school, and we went about a block towards downtown, and then we didn't know what we're supposed to do. We sat on the curb for a while, and it was boring, so we went back to school. When I left there, going to college, it was 1945, and the next year my father retired, and they started moving to Haines. It took about 2 years to get everything moved and a house built.
How did they get to Haines?
Over the road, rough road.
Rough road. It was a rough road, wasn't it?
Yes. One creek washed, the bridge washed out during the winter, and they had trees crossed. You just went over it, over a pile of bushes and trees.
In the college years, the temperatures there were kind of like this week, weren't they?
They were worse.
Worse, weren't they?
It wasn't, didn't feel as cold, but it would get to 50, 60 below.
And what did you do that I think is so ridiculous that you didn't get your degree?
Oh, I got married and had a baby. I had 3.5 years done.
And then you quit college and got married.
Well, that's what you did then. When you had a, mm-hmm. had a baby, you stayed home and took care of it.
That's right. And then you had 4 children, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we get to the good part. All those things and those silly things that happen.
One funny thing about being in Haines and dating and going out, one of my grandchildren asked me one day, he'd heard about courting days, and he wanted to know about my courting days in Haines. I had to stop and think for a while, and I said, well, we played baseball out of Mud Bay. We went fishing. If we could get a hold of a car, we'd go up to 11 miles to the pond there and go swimming. And he looked at me. He didn't sound like that was courting for him. But we got married, and we were married for 43 years before my husband died.
Yeah, your dating was always group dating. You generally didn't really hunt for any of the animals that were for food, did you?
No.
Okay, what happened one morning while you were in your nightgown?
Well, my husband hadn't got a moose that year, and that was important to our food supply. And the school bus driver pulled up, and my kids got on the bus, and Mr. Hibbler said, there's a moose down there on the beach at Mud Bay. And I was standing there in my bathrobe and my pajamas and my slippers. I grabbed the gun and headed down the road in the car, and I shot the moose. I'd never shot anything before. And I did have a license. After it went down, I didn't know what I was going to do with it because the tide was coming in. So I jumped in the car, and I charged down to the cannery hoping my husband had lollygagged instead of going right out fishing, and he had. He was on the fish tender, and he was having coffee there. And I went charging down the dock at the cannery in my bathrobe, and everybody in the cannery thought our house was on fire or something really important. So here I came down to the fish tender with this whole stream of people behind me. And all it was I needed him to take care of my moose. All the way home he kept saying, did it have horns? And I said, yeah. And pretty soon he said, are you sure it had horns? I said, yeah. And pretty soon by the time we got there, I wasn't even sure it had horns, but it did.
You've been listening to the recollections of Jean Clayton, Grace Elliott, Kim and Peter Metcalf, Alan and Connie Monroe, and Renee Garen Blood, recorded in January and February of 2009 as part of KTOO's StoryCorps series of interviews, presented tonight in conjunction with Friday's Day of Listening. To find out how you can record your own personal stories or those of your friends and family, check out our website, www.ktoo.org. This program was produced by Martha Moore, Katie Bosler, Ms. G, and Jeff Brown in the studios of KTOO News in Juneau. I'm Lisa Fu.